men will literally be miserable for their whole lives rather than go to therapy.
Hello, and welcome to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick, editor-at-large of Brightwall Darkroom and visiting assistant professor at Cornell University.
And I'm Chad Perman, editor-in-chief at Brightwall Darkroom. For our second episode, we're talking about our May theme, the films of 1971. So we're going to be talking about Carnal Knowledge today. Joining us again is senior editor of Brightwall Darkroom and co-writer of the newsletter 30, Flirty, and Film, and all-around wonderful person, Zosia Millman.
Hi, guys. Thanks for that introduction.
Good to have you back.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. Round two. Let's go.
Should we do a quick plot? Plot summary?
Let's get into it.
I mean, yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. Plot summary. So what we're looking at, I guess, structurally with Carnal Knowledge is like a three-act situation. We start with two horny Amherst students trying to get girlfriends and spending a lot more time talking about it than doing much of anything. We have helpless Sandy, played by Art Garfunkel, and stronger Jonathan, played by Jack Nicholson. And they both end up dating Candace Bergen's pre-law Smith student, Susan, until she and Jonathan split up. And we fast forward to adulthood when Sandy and Susan are married in the New York City suburbs, and Jonathan's canoodling brings him to firecracker Bobby, played by Anne Margaret, all of which sort of dissolves by act three, which is shorter, just sort of a short epilogue of disenchantment and erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah.
Happy 50th anniversary to that.
The three stages of life.
I was going to say, like, we, not that swerves won't be a part of what we do, but this was quite a swerve from Moonstruck.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking the whole time.
I was thinking, like, this is like the anti-Moonstruck. I mean, it's got some of the same, I get male energy in certain parts, but it's like they took the worst part of Nicolas Cage's energy and made a whole movie out of it and made it awful.
Yeah, it feels like both of them are about looking at the realities behind a rom-com and just in very different directions.
Mike Nichols, 40 years old, makes this movie. Like, I think that's a great place to start. Like, what is going on, and what did you guys think of just watching it?
Well, I watched it yesterday for the first time, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I feel like I was struck the whole time I was watching it by the fact that I was much more impressed and kind of like impressed with the filmmaking than I was like actually enjoying it, if that makes sense. I guess, I don't know. It felt like a lot of the story I didn't like, and I guess I just wanted more from a bunch of different parts of it. I mean, just like the look and the feel of these scenes, how everything feels kind of not even quite alien, but almost like I'm eavesdropping on state secrets or something. Like, it's not even, it doesn't have a vibe of kind of listening to friends talk or even listening to friends kind of locker room talk. It just really is like, I don't know, a window into a world that I constantly wanted to close.
That's very aptly said. And I mean, I feel like that was some of the point, though. Whether or not you want to enter that world, it seems like his point was to make you really hate being in that world, because it seems like a pretty miserable place to be.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it seems like kind of... I just think that kind of, like, ducks the point of it all, right? Like, I think watching an hour and a half of men kind of... You know, we have Sandy, who puts women on a pedestal, and we have Jonathan, who... the opposite, like, you know, he sees them purely as objects, and both of them are objectifying women in their own way. And I felt like, you know, maybe it is the difference between 2021 and 1971, but I didn't feel like I learned or advanced many points within that. And it was much more, it was obviously the film has that kind of three-act structure of kind of teenage years,
middle age, I guess, although I wasn't really clear on exactly how old they are. In their 20s, maybe, but
In the middle one?
And then...
I think I was like in my early 30s, maybe, but that's just my head wanting it to be 20s, 30s, and 40s. I don't know.
Yeah, and then, you know, in their, like, middle-aged 40s or whatever, and I felt like it's not an essay, like, it's not trying to make you understand these things, but I also felt like it didn't really jump anything, you know, like the parts that I found most interesting were kind of the parts around the film. And so I think the overall, like, yeah, sure, I get that nobody making that film sees them as good people, but I think it kind of ducks the point of, like, but was it actually interesting to watch them be bad people?
Yeah, this is like, well, I think this is the first time I've seen it all the way through. I did try to watch it once, and I was like, nope. I don't even remember how far I got. I think I was like in the first act somewhere, and I was having a really similar reaction to Zosha, where I was just like, this is not new ground, and it doesn't feel particularly entertaining or enlightening. But this time around, and maybe it was just because I knew we were going to have a conversation about it, but it was a fun movie to take notes on, I would say, but not so fun to watch. And there's a lot of, like, fellas, is it gay too energy in this movie? I feel like from the very beginning, like, that we're in darkness, they're having this like pillow talky conversation. Think it's a great opening, it's fantastic. It's totally arresting.
I mean, just cinematically,
Yeah, total. And I was imagining, like, being in a cinema in the dark with these voices. And it, even before we see their, like, dorm room, you totally get that sense of, like, twin beds in a room, you know? Mm-hmm. Or, like...
I was thinking more sleeping bags on the ground.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Like a sibling or, like, childhood buddy or like, boyfriend arrangement. I mean, there's just something really intimate about it. And thinking about how that intimacy sort of is between them in fits and starts through the film, and how it's never something that they sort of like get to experience with women.
Yeah, I think it's kind of unclear when the opening credit scene is supposed to take place, because it's, they talk about going to college, and Sandy kind of references that it's maybe not something he wants, and it's unclear if they're already there or if they were friends before that. But, you know, by the time the movie starts, they're clearly roommates. We do see their dorm room. You know, that it's actually, I feel like, a very good representation of dorm rooms on film, like, just very simple, very sparse, just two twin beds, a little bit of cheap furniture. And yeah, I mean, from there it just kind of goes into nothing but their sexual exploits, really, on that one. There's just no involvement of their actual schoolwork, or, you know, we don't even find out what it is that they are, like, majoring in or studying.
What classes are they even taking?
Yeah, until they're older and they're like, you're a doctor, I'm a businessman.
Yeah.
Yeah, the exposition's pretty great, yeah. Well, and I think it's important probably to note that it was originally written as a play. It was never performed as a play, but you can certainly very, very easily imagine this entire thing being a play. I think it would be even worse to watch as a play. But I do think that, I mean, because you know, Mike Nichols, like, I know a lot of people that watched his 80s or 90s movies kind of think of, like, you know, Working Girl or Regarding Henry or The Birdcage, but, like, he was doing a lot of crazy cinematic stuff, or at least it feels like his first few films were strongly influenced by, like, French New Wave and a bunch of European stuff without being, like, overtly, I mean, I guess I could make the case that The Graduate rips off a lot of stuff. It feels new and fresh to have it, like, translated through an American kind of sensibility. I don't know if it always works, but it's really interesting to watch how much he's trying to be a real filmmaker coming from, like, the Nichols and May background where no one's expecting this, and then he's doing this, or for Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Catch-22, and then this movie. It's quite a first string of four movies to put out into the world.
Yeah, I don't feel like this comes across as, like, irritatingly talky, the way a lot of, like, play-to-movie adaptations do. And probably because there is so much cinematic technique in terms of, like, the storytelling. And the way, like, the editing. I mean, okay, so for example, I'm thinking about the party scene in the first act when they both meet Susan for the first time. And we have this like luxurious deep focus where Jack Nicholson is like skulking in the background. And Sandy and Susan. I know, isn't it? Like, it just looks so great. And it forces us to have party gaze where you're like always looking for something better in the back or something. You're like, could I be in a different part of the room right now? And just forcing the spectator into that position, I think, is like fascinating. It's not just the men too, you know, like I, in watching it, was thinking about when Susan is walking with Sandy and sort of trying to articulate what she likes about him. Sounds rough. But she says something like, you know, I have to basically diminish myself around prospective suitors. Like they get a whiff of me being brighter than them. And it is something that I have to conceal because it'll threaten them ultimately. And I was like, yeah, that's still true.
Well, even that one line of like, and then I was like, oh yeah, this was a while ago, when he's like, oh, a female or a lady lawyer or something, like when she mentioned
a lady lawyer.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
What? And then you think like, oh yeah, this is like Gregory Peck in, you know, Gentleman's Agreement or whatever. Like this is that time when, yeah, there weren't even female lawyers. So yeah, there's a lot of different gender politics back then, but God, some of those lines really sound odd in 2021 out loud.
Yeah. I guess I appreciated the movie most when it felt less like it was trying to say like, yes, all men, and more when it was trying to be like kind of a character study of how these two extremes got these men into such a disheartening place. And I felt like I don't know, I think it was interesting reading some of the reviews, both of the time and kind of in the decades since, where a lot of men would write about it as like, that this is the movie that like pulled back the curtain more than a lot of other 1971 movies did. And, you know, like this is, it made men super defensive. And I was like, I know a lot of men in my life who would rightfully be super defensive about being portrayed as this. Like, it's very strange to see this as like, this is what the world is like. And I don't want to say that the movie was always doing that, but I think that sometimes it tinged a little bit into just a little, it came on a little strong in that way.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think anyone would have been surprised that Neil LaBute is one of the first people that pops up when you Google stuff, and he just talks about how this is a masterpiece. It's like, yeah, this is like his whole, he tried to make versions of this movie every time he made a movie and make them even feel worse. I do think Mike Nichols has got a basic humanity to him that saves some of it. And I think viewing it as a character study is probably what he intended, and the way, when I'm being most nice, kind to the movie, I think it is a really fascinating character study, and certainly it hits a lot different now than when I watched it, you know, for the first time like 20 years ago. So yeah, I just think that there's a lot of, I think a lot of people back then and even now probably don't really know how to talk about this movie. I think it's a tough one.
Yeah, that's definitely what I got from reading. And I think it's interesting because it is kind of set up in that initial pillow talk. I can't remember which man poses it to the other man, but the question is, you know, would you rather be loved or love? And I think that is kind of a good distillation of their faults, I guess, even though it's, you know, on its face, it seems a little more sweet. But I think, you know, like even just in the relationship with Susan, which is the first act when they're both at college, you know, Jack Nicholson sees it as a chase. He's trying to get laid. Like, I think you have, and then you have Sandy being kind of very sweet, but also trying to get laid. And I think both of them, I think what interested me most about that section is that both of them are like, neither of them are so on their respective extremes, I guess. Like, Sandy is not deceptive, but he's certainly selective in how he talks to Susan. And, you know, once he brings that energy back to Jonathan, is a lot even more selective about it. But I think it is kind of manipulative the way he goes about every single hookup scene. And then consequently, Jack Nicholson seems to only want Susan because Sandy wants her and because he makes her seem enticing, and is drawn to her for a lot of the reasons that he says he wouldn't care about with a woman, you know, like her intellect and the way she can talk to him and kind of be an equal person, if you can even imagine.
And they both really want the things they can't have. I mean, that's an obvious thing to say, but like that Jack Nicholson part that really hit me hard this time was the when he's like, she, you know, the Candace Bergen character is clearly smitten with him in some way. I don't know if smitten is the right word there. But he's just flying around like, I forget the exact line, but why can't you tell me my thoughts like you do with him? Like, he's had the girl, he's won the battle, but he's still like, but why can't we have this emotional intimacy? And then instead of trying to do things that might help him get that, he just follows her around and harangues her about like, why can't you tell me what my thoughts are? Why don't we have these wonderful conversations? It's just fascinating, like how nakedly he wants some of these things and how bad, I guess for both characters, how bad they are at getting the things they actually want, which is some form of like, you know, unattainable utopian intimacy emotionally and physically and platonically, but they're just never going to be happy. It's clear from like the first frame.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they try very hard, honestly.
Well, they have a limited tool set or toolkit. I think it's fascinating to watch men butt up against their limitations in this way. Like there are ways to get these things, not in the way that just sounded. There's a way to be happier in life, and they just have no clue how to do it and just chase it all over the place.
I don't even know that like the things that they talk about wanting are just like aesthetic perfection, like just like, you know, big tits. Yeah, the figure skater, like the mute, like totally aestheticized, like music box figurine figure skater that we then like end the film with in a totally enigmatic way. But I don't think any of that is like happiness exactly. And if anything, it seems like they see happiness as a trap, or they don't trust the sort of like stock idea of what happiness, how it arrives, or like what forms it's going to take. I mean, I think we really see that at the beginning of the second act at the end of the first act, when Susan and Jonathan break up, which is like so devastating. And in the dark, is such a good scene. She has such great like silences in that conversation. Like totally different in that way from his later breakup. Well, it's not a breakup as it turns out, but the sort of blowout fight he has with Anne Margaret's character, Bobby, where it's like screaming and tantrums. And in this, it's the camera like focusing on like the minute movements of like Candace Bergen's lower lip. And they're on the phone too. They're like at, you know, like they can't even see each other. But that's such a great example, I think, of how like they both Jonathan and Sandy like thwart any opportunity that they have at happiness at every turn.
I think that's an interesting point, but I feel like, I mean, there's so much in the movie that is their abstractions. I mean, right down to the locker room talk of just, you know, what they would want in this kind of like abstract woman whose measurements they seem to know, but nothing else. And I think what's interesting about when Jonathan's like, you know, is yelling at Susan to tell him his goddamn thoughts, and he's so jealous of the way they can complete their sentences, is that it does sort of seem like the reason she, I guess I can't say she loves him more, but, you know, like is drawn to him in a way that she's not to Sandy, is because he is kind of an enigma, and he is kind of that like bad boy she can't predict. And, you know, so much of literature is that. But I think that gets to the heart of both of these men want something outside the traditional happiness and have just done none of the thinking to figure out like what, you know, an ideal life actually looks like to them. And I think that they can't imagine a world in which, you know, your wife can't finish your sentences, and maybe that's that is in and of itself indicative of your bond. And they can't imagine a world in which, you know, you don't marry the sweetheart from college, or, you know, you find some other way to be happy, or you just go to therapy. I mean, like, more than anything else. But I think they have this kind of rigid idea of happiness, and they're rebelling against it, but not so much that they're really throwing out the whole thing. They're just sort of laughing at it from the inside, which is a cage.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't help thinking they want to be together throughout the film.
Yeah.
I mean, no, is that, I mean, not why you fuck your friend's girl? Because it's like a substitution.
There's a lot of that.
Yes, going on. When, yeah. Exactly.
The scene where they're celebrating Jonathan losing his virginity and he jumps in the pool, and then they're like roughhousing through the locker room. Yeah. Like, yeah, big, like, fellas, is it gay energy, as you said.
I know. It reminds me of, there's something where it's, someone says to someone else, like, has it even happened to you if you haven't told me about it yet? And I was thinking about that in this film, because especially for the first half, because we're cutting between things happening to them and then sort of aggressively kind of intercutting them just telling each other about it. It feels like there's this idea that, like, all of life is on two parallel tracks. So you're experiencing it, but then you're also narrating it to someone else and, like, reporting back. And
it does feel like that's what they're more into than the actual doing it. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, those are the conversations I think they're longing to have with women, but then they can't, because also at the same time they're doing that thing that men throughout time do, which is like, say they want to be with a really strong or intelligent woman, and what they really mean is, I just want to be thought of as the kind of person who wants to be with a really intelligent woman, but not actually expose myself to an actual one.
Yeah. Well, and that's getting at some of what, you know, Jack Nicholson, his character, if there was any ability to be vulnerable in him, he would have had a much easier path through this movie, but the movie doesn't let you off the hook that easily, because it's like, well, yeah, but look at Mr., you know, Arthur Garfunkel, sensitive, vulnerable man. But he's too in his head, and he's too... He shoots himself in the foot in different kinds of ways. So it also says, well, this is also not the path. And that's why I think it was Zosia who said earlier, it would suck as a man in 1971 to see this movie. And he's like, these are our two options. Like, choose your fighter. And these are the two. Yeah. Like, this is awful. And, you know, and it doesn't, I'm trying to think, is there even any other male characters in the movie besides those two?
No, it's really claustrophobic. Any, like, there's like no other characters. I mean,
there's other females that parade through the, they're not the ones parading, that are paraded through their lives. That movie that Jack Nicholson makes at the end.
Ball Busters on Parade.
Yeah. The whole first act makes you think there's going to be this confrontation when, Jonathan and Sandy realize that they're both sleeping with the same person and that Jack Nicholson is a horrible person for doing that. That never happens. And the only little tinge you get of that is when he accidentally puts her into this little movie he's showing and says, like, oops, that one's a mistake.
It's like truly a bizarre moment, because it's both our introduction to the third act. So, like, we are in this movie or slideshow or presentation or whatever, about the ball busters of his life, where he goes through all the women he's kissed and groped and, like, fucked over the years, and has...
Or even just liked.
Yeah, and just has that moment with Susan's picture, but skips over it. And then I think you are supposed to think that Sandy's picked up on it, because he does say, like, here's the first woman I slept with. And that's our introduction to kind of them in their 40s and, you know, their whole life and their continuing dynamics.
And it's also just really interesting, too, because, like, weirdly, the person who's kind of set up, at least at first in that scene, is the more moral authority there, Mr. Arthur Garfunkel, is literally dating, like, an 18-year-old. Carol Kane was great, but I mean, he's like, he's somehow not the bad guy in that scene, the 42-year-old dating the 18-year-old, because this other guy is showing this movie of every woman he's ever touched.
Yeah. I mean, I think something that the movie is nice and sets up when we first have, like, Susan as the joint, like, love interest, is that there isn't just one kind of bad guy. And obviously Jonathan is, like, more aggressive. He's more confident. He's more, like, egotistical. but Sandy is awful as well. And I feel like that really comes across. You know, that kind of, if anything, worse, I
was going to say, for me, he's worse. Yeah.
That kind of like sniveling, like bargaining, can't conceive of female desire because sex is a favor she's doing for me, but don't I deserve it? You know, capital N nice guy energy is just like so nauseating. So we get like, you know, no good guy, basically.
No good guy.
Yeah. It is a deeply unerotic film, and no good men.
Well, I mean, it's interesting too. I mean, we don't have to go too much into this, but that same vibe or energy, like leaving the theater. I remember leaving the theater after seeing Closer, which is one of Mike Nichols' last films. And I was like, I was like, I'm glad I saw that, but just, what a bummer that humans can be like this.
Yeah, similar in terms of like, just like film length explorations of, like insecurity, the unfairness of wanting to get close to people, but knowing that you can never know someone else's mind, like risk is never not part of it. There's always a threat that someone could be thinking something different or could leave you. And all the emphasis on talking in this film, both the talking the characters do with each other, but then how they talk about talking a lot also feels like it is interested, or at least the characters are interested in imagining like true communication or something, even though all they do is like dissemble. And as like Sandy and Susan talk about in the party scene in the first act, like put on acts with each other. Whether those acts are, as Susan argues, like more revelatory than they are like disguising, I think is something that the film is kind of interested in.
Yeah. And I think that's such a good point, that all that talk and all that talking about talking actually gets them no closer to any truth.
Oh, farther away. Yeah.
Especially when, I feel like we keep coming back to the college years, but you know, in the college years when, Jonathan is also dating Susan, and once he starts to get more serious with her and isn't just kind of pursuing his roommate's girlfriend to be a cad, he decides he needs a nickname for her, and that's when he calls her Myrtle. And that's also when Sandy is just sort of like, we should double date. And it's just like, oh, buddy, like,
you've both been dating these
girls
out.
For like less than a month. Calm down. And they're the same girl.
Well, again, isn't that just a substitution for them going on a date together? I mean, this is, I'm going to ride this horse until the end.
Well, no. I mean, I think your best point, Veronica, like, I can make, I think the scene that would show that a lot is that interiority again of, and Mike Nichols uses this a couple times. I posted one on Twitter last night because I was just obsessed with the Candace Bergen one. But he does the same thing with Jack Nicholson as Candace Bergen and Arthur Garfunkel are planning to go on a camping trip, and Jack Nicholson's just sitting there kind of like having to watch them plan it all. And it's like, he's jealous. He wants to go camping with Garfunkel. But it just, the camera just stays right on him as he observes them like talking about sleeping bags and sleeping on the ground and all this other kind of stuff. And it just focuses right in on him, and he just doesn't say anything, but you get like the whole point of what's going on for him with that, I think.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I'm going to read something. That's so dorky. My friend Kyle Stevens, Dr. Kyle Stevens, PhD, wrote a book on Mike Nichols. I know that a new book by Mark Harris is coming out or has come out.
It's out. Yeah, it's out.
Okay, on Mike Nichols. So Kyle's book is titled Mike Nichols, Sex, Language, and the Reinvention of Psychological Realism. And he has a whole chapter on carnal knowledge.
I bet.
Yeah. You know, can you imagine? No, I skipped it. And like the close up and interiority. So this is really short, but
Does he talk about that? Okay.
Yeah. He just has this one part that I highlighted this morning where he says the close up is the result of labor performed by the spectator, labor that occurs in the space where recognition and attribution meet. Reflecting on this labor, Nichols challenges the traditional close-up's promise of interiority. He pries the face and the close-up apart, uncovering the power of duration over facial expressivity. And I do think this idea of duration is so key, right? Like, that's, you know, watching her micro expressions kind of flit around and change in that, in Candace Bergen's extended close-up in the bar when she's clearly seated between the both of them, still dating both of them. They don't, or I guess Sandy doesn't know that she's with Jonathan as well. And you see her kind of like cut these like side eyes when she's irritated mm-hmm. with something that yeah. Sandy's saying, or, you know, and I feel like, you know, that feeling when you're in a group setting and like your friend or your partner, like someone that you're sort of socially responsible for, is just like dropping the ball and you're like, come on, mm-hmm. like pick it up. And then in the Nicholson close up, it's like he doesn't do any of that.
No,
he's just like dead in the eyes.
Well, that's, I mean, it's, I think, interesting. That's the point too. He's dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And he never gets alive again.
Yeah. And we never, I mean, the part two, I mean, you know, my therapist had on, like, I just want to know the backstory, like how we just meet them in college and they're like this, but how in the world do you get to be like these two guys? Well, other than, you know, other than just being raised in America.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's probably pretty normal.
Well, but I mean, but you have to, I mean, I don't even think you have to be a therapist to be like, okay, so there's something going on with Jack Nicholson and his mom somewhere in there. And probably Arthur Garfunkel as well. I'm just going to keep saying, I just love Arthur Garfunkel. By the way, side note really quick, this is the movie that broke up Simon and Garfunkel. So that's worth mentioning.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Can I go on a tangent for a second?
Yeah.
I mean, I knew the backstory vaguely, but I actually just read about it last night, so I'd have the facts straight. But so Mike Nichols, because that's another fascinating part about what he was doing in the early part of his career that he kind of got way away from later. He would pick out these people that, I mean, Jack Nicholson obviously is not a big pull in 1971 in terms of like, yeah, he seems great. Anne Margaret had never been in a movie remotely like this. She'd made, you know, 20 or 30 years of movies exactly the opposite of this. No one even knew she could do that. And so a year or two, so The Graduate, you know, Simon and Garfunkel do the music. And then for Catch 22, Mike Nichols gets this idea to say, hey, let's put Simon and Garfunkel in the movie. So he actually wrote parts for both of them. And then near the end, he contacted Paul Simon. He's like, oh, we need to cut your part out, so I guess we should get rid of Artie's part too. And then Paul Simon's like, no, you got to keep Artie in there. That's fine. Just cut my part. But then for the next movie, Mike Nichols liked Garfunkel in Catch 22. So he made, or he asked him to be in Carnal Knowledge. But then this is like, this is great because it's another scene of men not knowing how to talk. Garfunkel didn't tell Simon that he was going to be in the movie. So Simon found out through, here comes the cool part. I mean, it's all cool. So the person that told Paul, I just love this sentence. The person that told Paul Simon that Garfunkel was going to be in Mike Nichols' movie was randomly Charles Grodin. And so these faces are great. You guys are making. Yeah. So Charles Grodin drops the secret. And then Simon says, like, okay, that's it. I'm done with Simon and Garfunkel. Clearly, like, this guy can't tell me anything. And that was there where their whole split happened. I'm sure there was other stuff going into it, but it was it's because he made this movie in secret. And when Paul Simon asked him, why didn't you tell me? He said, I thought you'd be worried about it. So it was this whole thing, like, that almost replicates some of the problems of males talking. But anyway, and it was filmed mostly during the recording of Bridge Over Troubled Water, which is just fascinating to think about, like, Garfunkel being like, here I am singing this Paul Simon song that I'm going to get all the credit for because of my beautiful falsetto voice. And Paul Simon hates him because he's like, your stupid voice. I wrote this song and the song is what matters. And then he goes off and films Carnal Knot. There's just layers on layers. So that's my tangent. We now return to our regular scheduling program.
Well, Ari mom issues.
Yeah. Circling back to the moms.
Well, when you were like, you know, there must be like something mom here. I mean, yeah, right? Because not only does he narrate that he's had these sort of twisted ways of relating to women since he was like six or something, I think, is the beginning of this history of relationship slideshow. Yes, Ballbusters on Parade at the end of the film. But also, because we haven't really talked about the second act, but a lot of it is with Anne Margaret, Bobby. And when they meet and they're having their like, are we going to go home together cab conversation, There's definitely some like explicit like mommy role play in that moment. Where she's like, "Do you want to be mothered?" And he says, "I want to be smothered."
Yeah,
it's just kind of a weird, especially for a movie that's so about talking. It's so funny to have this like kind of. It's not a Freudian slip, but this slipperiness of language. A Freudian like slideshow.
Yeah, and how the slipperiness of his language, it's like kind of charming in the moment, but it ultimately doesn't amount to anything. Like, it's not particularly clever. It's not particularly cute, or like, again, I cannot overstate how unerotic this movie it is. Like, none of the things they do are like hot. Like, it's just
great date movie.
There's nothing really there except for kind of the like maybe the crackle of excitement that you would feel in the back of that cab. But like, yeah, that communication adds up to nothing. It goes nowhere. It's just, you know, it just is what
it is. I mean,
there's
costuming. Anne Margaret's cleavage is prodigious in that
dinner. I couldn't find sources on it, but something in Ebert's review yes. from said it was digitally enhanced, her chest.
Yeah, he said he says it's fake, and I was like, I don't know if it's like prosthetics, because I definitely had that thought when she stands up to go into the shower, and I was like, I can't believe we are seeing her side boob. And then reading that review, I was like, I'm gonna have to look this up later, because what a weird tossed off detail that is to just say like, obviously that's not Anne Margaret's boobs.
And in the course of looking for that, I found out there was apparently a ton of Jack Nicholson nude scenes that just never made it into
the
movie.
Oh, yeah, I read that, too.
But he would like, make everybody, like... Sorry, everybody that has to know this now, but I have to know it. He calls it Steve.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
He would show up on set naked and be like, Steve's here today. Oh, I was like, God. Oh, my God, Jack Nicholson, what's happening?
Such a... is that modesty,
it's probably him being uncomfortable being naked, but...
I mean, speaking of kind of the modesty of it, it is interesting that there's the whole scene when Bobby asks Jonathan if they can move in together, and he's just gotten out of the shower, and she's sitting there, and it's cut from, like, her kind of clavicles up, so, like, we're not seeing anything, but she's clearly supposed to be just, like, sitting post-coital in bed naked. Yeah, and just, you know, just sitting, like... completely bare-chested and just like up front, and like Jack Nicholson is on a chair, he's kind of squirmy, he's like got a towel covering himself, and he's, you know, like folding his legs. Like, it is such a difference in their physicality, and kind of reflects how they're portraying themselves in this relationship. Like, you know, she's like, I'm just asking you to move in together, read into that what you will, but I'm not asking you to get married at this moment. And he's like, okay, just so we're on the same page. And it's
a tricky thing. Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. I feel like she cut, you know, she's so brassy and cool. And then, and he's like, you know, don't work. They move in together. She quits her job. It's so sad to see, like that particular relationship disintegrate. And we don't even see the relationship between Sandy and Susan disintegrate. We know they got married. We know that he's doing like the Don Draper, like suburban New York, our life sucks now, but we don't have to talk about it that way kind of thing. But then they clearly split up, and she just kind of dissipates from the film.
Yeah, she's not in the film at all after the first act. We just hear him talk about how the first thing we hear is that he appreciates her keeping a tidy house because it would be so annoying for him to come home from work and have to clean the house. And then before we know it, he's dating somebody else and bringing that somebody else over to Jonathan's apartment to hang out, maybe swap partners at times. But I mean, by the time they're doing that, the relationship between Jonathan and Bobby, like Veronica said, she's quit her job. Like, she won't leave her house. She's clearly massively depressed. And all Jack Nicholson can really do is just sort of like needle her about her insecurities and her failures to him. And, you know, there is that great shot of kind of before you even know it, she's taking something out of the oven and then walks the long way across this apartment and brings it, and they're just eating dinner, like a
you know, oven dinner in bed together, and he's just like, "Is there any beer?" And she says, "No." And he's like, "I should have told you to get it when I called this afternoon. Like, that's on me, but also it's on you." And
also,
like,
what did you do all day? Yeah,
yeah. Like, it's just, it's so painful. And during that, you know, she walks past the giant blow up of her in the living room, and then there's the thing on the picture on the nightstand too. And I feel like it is kind of deployed so nicely, where throughout the different stages we see them at, there are pictures of her, these glamour shots all over the apartment, and they just feel like complete background noise. Like, it's not a picture you even really look at, it's not a picture you think about, it's just there kind of almost out of obligation on Jonathan's part and on her part.
And by the time Sandy is seeing this, like, new woman post Susan, Cindy, right?
Yes.
Cindy, bobbed Cindy. So it's like a total illustration of them wanting what each other has, which, again, I would just insist is a version of them wanting each other. She just kissed. But yeah, Jonathan is complaining about Bobby and saying that she's really passive. Sandy's complaining about Cindy, saying that she's giving orders in bed. And they're both sort of like, well, I could, you know, I could do with a bit of that, whatever the thing I don't have is. Yeah. And I mean, obviously the swap is failed.
I think that's the key, that whatever the thing is that I don't have. Yeah. That's kind of the through line of the whole movie.
Yeah. The swap is failed.
Well, and they both, I mean,
yeah,
I don't know if they ever explicitly stated, but it always seems like they think they've just about figured it out, both of them in it. And they're like, when I just make this one move, then finally everything's going to be, this is all going to be worth it, and it's all going to make sense, and I'm going to be content and have what I want. But of course, I mean, you can see from very early on that's never going to happen unless they change who they are. The pretty fascinating part, and I guess we should mention probably Jules Pfeiffer, who wrote the whole thing. One is that the guy who wrote this has a career as, like, you know, a legendary cartoonist, which is not what you think when you when you watch this, that, like, he's known mostly for cartoons. But also just that there's so much in there. The decision by Jules Pfeiffer and then Mike Nichols to capture it cinematically, they don't change. I mean, Arthur Garfunkel's facial hair changes. But other than that, they don't change really at all in terms of how they approach any of these things. And so it's that whole misattributed but off-quoted phrase about, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. It's like, this is like that in a 98-minute movie. Until it finally ends with Jack Nicholson being like, fine, fuck that. I am just going to straight up pay someone to tell me what I want them to say. And please, let's get to the ending a little bit, because that is so fascinating.
Yeah. So the third act, we kick, as we've said, that we kick off with the slideshow that Jack Nicholson is showing in his, like, spacey 70s apartment, which is, like, covered in tinsel, and, like, there's, like, a kind of velveteen bubble chair. Yeah. His outfit is cool, though, I have to say. Like, the smoking slippers, and then kind of exaggerated collar, no tie.
He's made one good choice in his life.
It truly is. Outfit. I was like, it's a cool outfit, though. So then they're talk. So Sandy has brought over Carol Kane, who, as we've said, is like 18 supposedly, and I think
and knows more about life than any of us.
So then afterward, Jonathan and Sandy are walking on the street and kind of talking, and it does seem like Sandy is, like, narrating that he's changed and that change is necessary to adapt and evolve.
Yeah.
But to me,
do you believe that?
No.
I mean, him. Do you believe his change? Yeah, I didn't believe
it. No. And it just sounds like every older guy who is, like, dating a teenager, essentially, and sort of, like, you know, vampirically leeching off of
all their
freshness and, you know, innocence or whatever, even though he claims it's not innocence. I mean, so basically we don't get, you know, one went one way and things turned out great, and the other went the other way. I mean, they both are
Both went different paths, and they both ended up being ridiculous at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think by the end, Jonathan has lived his whole life seeing everybody. I think the movie certainly underscores the men versus women dynamic of his mindset, but I think you can also say that he does just see himself in opposition to everybody around him, men or women, which is why he goes after his roommate's girl. But I think then you have Sandy, who sees himself as kind of like learning and doesn't see it as leeching, even though that's what we understand it to be. Like, you know, he's not like leveling up by refusing to acknowledge these women's personhood. He's just sort of not understanding them as full people and just pretending like that's what actually learning from them is. And the movie is just, you know, like Chad was saying, that they don't change in the meaningful ways that they really think they do on any sort of level. And as a viewer, that can be very frustrating to see. And, you know, it's also, I think, a good reminder of just how each of the choices in your life can lead you to the next one and can kind of like bring you down a hole if you can't like reflect, yeah, I guess, exactly, enough to get yourself out of it. But, you know, if you can't actually take, yeah, if you can't take any time to really acknowledge what brought you there or kind of these forces in your life and change them or at least understand mm-hmm. them and do them with intention, then you're just going to be miserable.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like that Twitter men will literally blank instead of go to therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only the movie.
Men will literally be miserable for their whole lives rather than go to therapy.
That's good.
Yeah, it is.
That's very carnal knowledge. I actually feel like Jonathan, to his credit, like if I had to pick a path for him, paying a woman for her labor.
I mean, he could have just, yeah, done that 20 years ago and skipped all this nonsense.
I know. And just like write the script, have her deliver it.
He gets mad at her for saying for improvising her bills off the script.
I feel like that's great. So let's talk about the ending, because it is like so iconic. I feel like
it really
weird.
Came out of nowhere for me. I was definitely like, this movie's movie's only an hour and a half. Like, how much longer can it be? And then just
okay. All right. Totally.
Well, and it starts with the casting too.
Rita Moreno deserves
Rita
better.
Moreno, and like, again, bizarro, brilliant casting. Like,
yeah,
for that little part. Yeah. It'd be amazing to see how he talked her into that. But
she's also like the sort of age, well, not to be, you know, age discourse guy, because I'm, I don't want to be that guy, but she is the sort of like age compatible choice, because I think she's like mm-hmm. 40, Rita Moreno, by the time in 71, I think. She looks great.
Yeah, be about right. Yeah, she does.
So we see Jonathan like arrive to her place. Rita Moreno opens the door. So she like answers the door and they start doing this seduction conversation, and it's not, I'll say it was not entirely clear that this was scripted until she makes a sort of misstep as they're bargaining. They're having this playful conversation.
The sky is the limit.
Yeah, she says the sky's the limit. Like, want to bet how much? The sky's the limit. And he's like, he just flips out. Jonathan flips out and is like, that's not it. She's like, is that?
I've never
not
said
it?
That before.
Which really gets right to the heart of like neither seduction nor conversation.
And also, I want to literally program a woman to say what I want her to say and not have to deal with any of this off-script stuff.
Yeah.
Off-script stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then after,
I mean,
she like delivers this monologue, which is the rest of, I mean, it's funny. In that moment,
God,
he
that
really
monologue,
is like the playwright, the director, right? Like writing the monologue, producing the scene.
And he takes shots at Garfunkel, even though he's not there. He has her say, like, not the weak kind of strong.
Right.
Something like that.
Not like your friend, she might as well say.
Yeah. I'm sure in some version, she's like, not like your stupid friend, Sandy.
Yeah. He's like, no,
you're the
you
winner
to
of
say
this
it like that.
yeah and the whole thing we haven't even touched on, the whole point here is that he's got erectile dysfunction and can't get an erection, so her whole seduction that he's written for her to say is for him to be able to get an erection, and that's how the movie ends,
which she has to like narrate it as it rises.
She has to
literally comment
like,
on what Steve's up to.
Yeah, she has to narrate it, amp him up, and by the end, like, she is completely out of frame.
Right.
Like, we are just hearing her voice. Right. She's just disembodied even further than she already felt.
Yeah, and it's the first time that whiteout makes sense. Like, I love the whiteout aesthetically, but that's the first time when it's like, okay, this and the whiteout into the figure skater. It's like, oh, very artsy.
It is,
but yeah,
artsy.
Just,
yeah.
It's a beautiful moment after such a, just like, God, I just don't want to watch movies ever again moment. Because it's, yeah, that twitch. I mean, how does that leave you guys in terms of like this brilliant kind of little artsy turn at the very end after just this awful scene? like, what's the feeling you leave with as a result of that twirling figure? For me, it was like, okay, this is always out of reach, and it's still out of reach. But I don't know if that's how everyone else responded to it.
Yeah. I mean, there's something, I think, so because we see these sharp white screens punctuate the acts moving into each other. So from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and then the end. And they feel different, I think, from like a fade to black. Right. And they also feel different, I would say, from something like in Age of Innocence, those like saturated floods with color or something. They feel like strokes or something. Like there's something really.
It does feel a little bit like stroking out, yeah.
You know, like disorienting and kind of, I don't know, like too fast or something.
It's like the most depressing, like, because instead of a fade to black, it almost feels like a fade to more life, and the more life is just miserable.
Yeah. Totally. And then the fact that we have that at the end and then we just see something we've already seen feels depressing, but appropriate for the rest of the film. You know, like this again, it was always this. It was always like the dream of the figure skater seen from above, a remote image of like beauty that doesn't talk and has no name.
Yeah. And looks filmed, great. Filmed by one of the best like cinematographers like working in like an Italian legend. Like, I don't know how to say the last name, but Giuseppe Rotano. But he literally made Amarcord, Fellini's movie, like the next year. He was making a Fellini movie this year. He won the Oscar for All That Jazz a few years later. But he'd worked with everybody from like in Italian cinema, like Visconti and Fellini and all these people. And just died last month at like 97.
Oh, no. Okay. There are some cinematographic like set pieces in this movie. I mean, the sex scene between Jonathan and Bobby, where we like push through the apartment and sort of follow the sound of them having sex for, well, not for the first time, I guess, but it's awesome.
Well, and the one thing I too, I know we are getting near the end here, but just to contextualize, like, so if it starts in the 40s-ish, 50s-ish, I'm not really exactly sure what
40s, where this, okay.
So the and ends by 71. I mean, I guess anyone familiar with Mad Men knows the journey more intimately. But the definition of manhood was changing as all this was happening. Like in the 40s, they would not have been that out of context with where most men probably were. By 1971, it is pretty bizarre to be where Jack Nicholson is in the culture. I mean, just culturally, like that's not where that was not. It was starting to change. Like, hey, this you know, the same thing Don Draper went through. Like you can't be like this anymore. And I'm sorry you don't have another gear. but it's so both that it's, you know, 50 years ago, which is amazing. But also this is the first time like a condom was in a movie ever. And then also that, you know, someone that showed this movie, just a theater owner in Georgia got taken to all the way up to the Georgia Supreme Court for distributing profanity and upset. Like this was like a hugely controversial movie when it came out just because of the content. And I think watching it 50 years later, of course we don't really feel that cause we've seen, you know, Bad Grandpa or whatever, but it's just a very, it's hard to put ourselves back. And then I always want to make note of that whenever we talk about films from 50 years ago, it's like, we are guessing here 50 years later, but there was a lot of stuff that was pretty cutting edge. Not just cinematically, but content wise, it was really pushing the envelope.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's still interesting because so much of it is like suggestive. I mean, even carnal knowledge is a leading euphemism.
There's not a lot in
right?
there. Yeah.
And there is something just kind of euphemistic about a lot of the film cinematically. Like we don't, you know, like that shot that where we push through the apartment, we don't really, it's not like we see positions exactly, you know, there's not that much revealed to us.
It's just as sexy as Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, it's just like that same kind of like,
it is,
this is not sexy.
Way less sexy than Eyes Wide Shut.
No, it's, I mean, I don't,
I mean, let's put a pin in that.
But it's got that same coldness. It's got a Kubrickian coldness to it that, I guess, I mean, that was the same year he was putting out A Clockwork Orange. So he was more brutal.
Should we wrap this up?
Yeah. So if the first episode was feel good, this is the anti first episode. Yeah. We're just showing you the range here.
We need both.
It's not just always going to be us talking about movies we love so much.
Should we do Last Call?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do Last Call. So this is where we're going to ask you, Zosia, for a thing that you have watched recently. and a staff recommendation, something that from the video store of your mind you would put on our shelf.
Okay, so for the last thing I watched, another important entry into the Just Let Them Kiss canon, which is Godzilla vs. Kong. Oh
my
god!
My son is begging us to watch that, and I will not let it happen, so yes. Tell me a little bit about it.
Oh my god. It's so good. I love monster movies, and I just love the pathos of big monsters. I don't know what to say, like... our producer told me that she saw it in IMAX, and I'm super jealous.
Oh my god!
Waiting on that other
get that my next vaccine yeah.
shot. Yeah, I had to get gotta you're, go to the
wait.
The movie
you're the least vaccinated
just to catch
person
this.
On this podcast. This is a very vaccinated podcast.
Oh, I'm only one.
I know. I was gonna yeah. say.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Oh my god, that's such a good one. My boyfriend and I watched that the past 2 days as well. And I
the past few days?
Yeah, cuz like you yeah, you
oh, in parts. Like, okay. Yeah.
You know. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
And I was saying the exact same thing, Sosha. I was like, are they going to kiss?
Yeah.
Are they going to kiss now? How about now? Like I just am 11 and
I was like, what better way to have a couple come together than a mecha version of one part of a couple. Like, truly, it's a love story for the ages. I think we can all acknowledge. I mean, it's almost too cliche now that I've said it out loud.
Great double feature possibility.
That is the pairing.
I mean, my double feature possibility feels like much more like mundane. I feel like Ex Machina would make a great double feature. That's like another film that's like just about men projecting onto, well, in this case, like, quote-unquote women, but, you know, the projections that happen when masculinity and gender enter the chat.
Very well put, yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I got. Okay. That's a great triple feature.
So the triple feature is Carnal Knowledge, Ex Machina, and...
And then, yeah, I'd end with, yeah, Godzilla versus Kong. I feel like you always gotta...
That's where it's always heading, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we'll probably make like August Godzilla versus Kong month. So, you know.
You're going to have to get the approval of the editor-in-chief on that one. But thank you for being here. It was great.
Thank you for having me. It's so fun, as always.
Sorry that
have
we had you watch such a bummer, but you had a lot of great stuff to say about it. So it was great to have you on.
Thank you, Sosha, for joining us so much. Where can we find you on the internet?
Usually by Googling my name. I got high SEO. I'm also at Zosha M on Twitter. So if you want to find me, you can look there.
That's perfect.
And Veronica, where can we find you?
You can find me at well, I guess at vfits.tumblr.com. That's my personal website.
Old school.
I'm old. And my Twitter is at Gudomako. Gutomako. Nice. Yeah. And Chad, thank you to you. Where can we find you?
Yes. I am on the internet as well. And if you Google me, it takes you to my therapy page. So skip that part and go to the next part. Make an appointment. No, I'm full right now. So no appointments. So it's just everybody_cares on Twitter. And then just a bunch of stuff on brightwalldarkroom.com, which is the wonderful site that we're all a part of.
Awesome. This podcast is generously edited and produced by Victoria Alejandro. Thank you, Victoria.
All right. And we'll see you next time when everyone is vaccinated fully. I completely lost my thread as I started thinking about Jules Pfeiffer. Sorry. Someone bail me out.
Well, I want to... What was I going to say about... Oh, I forgot to...
Yeah, I think this part can just get cut.
Now we're just Josh and we're just hanging out with microphones.